You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 85 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. And yeah, that's about the right way to start this podcast. What a week. What a week.
So 1 week ago today, you said this coming week that we just experienced had a chance to be the greatest week in Seattle sports history.
I'm pretty sure I didn't say that. Did I?
Yeah, you did.
I thought I said that it would be having a chance to be the biggest week in Seattle sports history, which there's a difference between big and great. And we found out that the difference was the difference between the first 3 days of the week in the last 4 days of the week.
Now, we need to debate whether this was the worst week in Seattle sports history.
I don't think it can be the worst week in Seattle sports. I mean, we'll see. Again, as we've talked about last week, a lot of this is contingent on we're not going to know for like at least 5 years down the road, maybe decades down the road, the ramifications of some of this.
That's how bad this week was. It had implications not just for the season of teams. We are talking decades-long bad week.
All right, so we're going to obviously do a full recap and analysis as we go through this podcast, as we normally do. But let's quickly, at the top, recap everything that happened over the last week.
Before we do that, let's talk about what we're drinking here so we have something to pour out with each awful thing that happened, or toast to with the one or two good things that did happen.
So we are having the Golden Road Brewing from LA Back Home Gingerbread Stout, which is brewed with spices to, I assume, taste like gingerbread.
There we go.
Which sounds delicious. Although I got to tell you, the cans are like white and gold, and they are not nearly as appealing to me in the holiday season as the box, which was red, and that felt more festive. I don't know how you feel about this issue.
I guess I agree with that.
Unless these, by the way, are actually black and blue.
This might be the first... Is that the dress joke?
It is the dress joke.
Timely stuff. Golden Road Brewery might be the first LA brewery that we've drank on this podcast.
That seems likely. Yeah, it's not a big microbrew culture in LA.
LA is like 5 to 10 years behind when it comes to small craft brewing, right? So Golden Road, it feels like to me, has kind of led the way as far as spreading beer from LA nationally. And in my experience with them, I think it's not great.
I think my experience has been generally positive. I think I may have had some in LA at one point. They seem to have really good distribution, though, is what they have more than anything, I would say, about Golden Road. All right, should we crack these open? To the week.
Cheers to this week being over.
Yeah, it's true. It's not bad. It's not overwhelmingly gingerbready.
Tastes like beer.
Yeah, it's probably fair. All right. So,
okay, let's run through the week in Seattle sports.
Do I want to go back all the way to like the 7 day span that was actually great? Do you want me to go that far back?
Well, we're not counting the Seahawks win versus the Eagles.
Okay, you don't want that then.
No.
All right, so Monday, we have the Seattle City Council votes 7-1 to approve the Key Arena renovation memorandum of understanding. Wednesday, that gets signed by Mayor Jenny Durkan in a press conference on the Seattle Center campus. And then later that night, UW men's basketball.
Wait, can we go through and talk about whether these things add to it being the greatest week or the worst week in Seattle sports history?
I feel like we got to save that.
Okay, because to me, those two feel like the arena stuff, bit of a mixed bag. We'll talk about that more later. But if you're a fan of hockey, this might be greatest week stuff.
Yes.
If you're a fan of basketball.
Greatest week since the 1917 Stanley Cup.
You know, only 100 years. If you're a fan of basketball, let's say that the review is mixed, but we'll talk about that more later.
We will.
Okay.
All right. Then later Wednesday, UW men's basketball goes into the Sprint Center in Kansas City and takes down number 2 Kansas. A shocking upset that captivated a nation's attention.
Obviously contributes to this being the best week in Seattle sports history.
A toast to this. This is like one of the great wins in UW basketball history. I mean, it's obviously not as meaningful as, you know, for example, I was trying to debate what was the best win of the Romar era.
Stanford. Stanford's undefeated coming to Seattle. It kind of clinched. Putting the Huskies on the map as a national program. And they were still in the bubble for the NCAA tournament at that point.
That is true. They definitely needed that win. They weren't going to win the Pac-12 12 or Pac-10 tournament at that point, which they didn't. I was going to go with winning the Pac-12 championship with Isaiah Thomas against Arizona, the cold-blooded buzzer beater.
That was a big one.
The other one I thought about was Quincy Pondexter's game winner to beat, now I can't remember what team that was.
Oh, what a memorable game.
It was a memorable game. I just can't remember who the opponent was.
And what was the situation?
That was in the first round of the NCAA tournament.
Marquette.
Yes. And the Huskies, of course, went on to the Sweet 16 that year.
I still think it was a Stanford win.
So, but anyway, there was no obvious pick. And there was no team the Huskies knocked out. I mean, Stanford was undefeated, but at home, a very different situation. Also, that Stanford team, quietly not actually that good, even though they were undefeated. But Kansas, number two team in the country, in what amounted to a road game, just a shocking outcome. Especially yes. for a team that there were not high expectations for in Mike Hopkins' first season as coach.
Yes. So things are looking up for the week. We are saying to yourself, this is going to be the greatest week in Seattle sports history. And then you tweet out.
I didn't even say anything positive about it, for the record. I just said the last 7 days in Seattle sports and listed things. I didn't even say positive or negative.
There was an implication.
I suppose there was.
And that tweet cursed us.
Things took a U-turn at that point. So Thursday night, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver is asked to comment on the Key Arena plan. Not super enthusiastic about it. We'll get to that and how much to read into it later. But that's kind of started things.
That was the moment.
Friday, it took a really dark turn. We had our hopes so high for Shohei Ohtani, which apparently is how it's pronounced. And then he not only doesn't pick the Mariners, he goes to a division rival. The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim.
Oh, my. I mean, we knew at that point. That was the moment.
Oh,
like, the Adam Silver quote you could have read in a couple of different ways. But when Ohtani signed with the Angels, that was it. The week was ruined.
Worst week ever.
Yep.
Saturday. Sounders playing for the MLS Cup at Toronto FC. Lose 2-0. In a desultory performance, I would say. Sunday. Seahawks lose at Jacksonville. Lose Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright to injuries over the course of the game. Then immediately followed by Husky men's basketball.
There's some things that you're not mentioning here. Because, mention Husky men's basketball. Because there's other things to add to this.
Capping the week with a 27-point home loss to Gonzaga.
This is just on-the-field stuff that we're talking about. Because off the field, the Seahawks game, before the game even happens, news comes out that Malik McDowell was arrested in an incident in a nightclub in Atlanta.
Yes.
After the game, or as the game was winding down, technically there was still time on the clock, Quentin Jefferson gets into a fight with fans in the stands and tries to climb the wall into the stands to potentially fight with them. Also on Sunday, to kind of knock down that win against Kansas to make it less exciting, it was a good Arizona State team, but Arizona State also goes into Kansas and beat Kansas, who now don't even look like a top. Like, if they lost to the Huskies, they're a top 10 team maybe after that. Losing these two games, they're what, number 20 in the country, something like that?
They may struggle to finish any higher than 8th in the Pac-12 this year. They're really struggling with the Pac-12. All right. Should we talk first off? Again, I don't feel like I'm to blame for this.
You're to blame. This is your fault. Anytime that you recognize, like, it's no-hitter rules, right? That's what we have to function on in these situations.
I don't know if I believe in no-hitter rules.
You don't believe in no-hitter rules?
But also, this was not a no-hitter.
You're talking to the person who wore the same jersey today because I wore it against the Eagles last week and the Seahawks won. And anytime that the Seahawks win a game and I'm wearing something, you can bet that I'm going to be wearing that the next week.
Yeah. I mean, that checks out. I did the same thing. I'm not going to deny that I did the same thing, but I recognize you don't that it was irrational.
I remember times when you've turned your jersey inside out at halftime.
Yeah, that's
and you
true.
Don't believe in no-hitter rules?
Not in this case. Not when it's a completely unrelated set of sports events
in a city.
You just
don't talk about it. When things look good, you don't talk about it. When things are bad, you're fine to talk about it. But when things look good, you acknowledge them after they happen.
So would you say if we were going to podcast on Thursday that we should not have podcasted then? Because we would have had to talk about things?
You can talk about things after they happen, but you can't preview things positively.
All right. I suppose that's fair.
So that's why this is your fault.
I guess it is all my fault. It has nothing to do with any of the teams involved or players or coaches or the other teams who did quite well against the Seattle teams. It's all me.
I mean, really, what happened was this was a lot of teams who had opportunities that they had worse than 50% chance to win those games.
Yes. We said less than 50% for both the Sounders and the Seahawks.
I think I said 50-50 for the Seahawks.
Oh, did you? Yeah, that's right. I feel vindicated in my 40-60 comment.
Really? Because I feel like if there wasn't a defensive holding call, the Seahawks would have won. Well, but anyway.
We can get into that. And we didn't do chances of victory for UW and Gonzaga, but definitely those would have been less than 50-50.
Yes. We did Ken Pomeroy's chances of victory, which I think were 2%.
For Kansas,
For Kansas, and I think 14 for Gonzaga. Yeah. So there was a set of games that the Seattle team was not expected to win. And they lost all of them.
They actually probably ended up winning as many games as they should have if you count UW beating Kansas.
Yes.
Just not maybe the distribution we would have chosen ahead of time.
Yes. I mean, the Seahawks could save the week with a victory at Jacksonville.
Very much.
But one thing did happen that redeems the week after, not all of these games, but after the Seahawks, and that's the other team we were cheering for, Philadelphia Eagles.
Yeah, that's right. Because also leading up to that, Green Bay had won, Atlanta won on Thursday night, Carolina won.
Atlanta, Carolina, Detroit, Green Bay. Every single team we were cheering against won. And I was like, the Seahawks are screwed. When you see all these other teams winning, mm-hmm. and there was a moment when the Seahawks, I think, were down by maybe 17, and the Rams were up, and Carson Wentz was injured.
Yeah, like, looks very bad.
This is not happening. Nick Foles ain't leading two scoring drives.
Well, apparently he was.
And then he did.
With his 4.2 yards per attempt. Shouts to Nick. Toast to Nick Foles.
Yeah, really. That's who we should be toasting to. At one point in the game.
The savior of the Seattle sports scene.
I don't think it was available in Seattle, but it was like, we should be paying more attention to this Eagles-Rams game than we are to the Seahawks game.
That seems like an overreaction, but I get that the leverage was higher because the Seahawks were so unlikely to win at that point. All right, should we get into the week?
Can we hone in on the Seahawks-Jaguars game first and then talk... Are you not okay with that?
I mean, sure.
Let's talk through the Jaguars-Seahawks game first, and then go through the weekly business, starting with the Sonics Arena. By the way, this podcast is coming out earlier in the week. This will be the only Pelton cast for the week.
Yeah, this is not just a review podcast. This is the normal weekly pod. So we got good Bortles, I think, for the most part. You know, there were a couple throws here or there where Bortles, but for the most part, he was pretty damn good in this game.
I mostly agree with that. I mean, it's so hard to talk about this game because the way they thought it in the first half completely changed by the end of the game. And, you know, the conclusion of the game also changed things. But
well, they were basically two different games, I would say. I mean, you have a 3-0 game at halftime where the Seahawks, because of a Blair Walsh missed field goal late in the half, fail to score, as opposed to then a third quarter where there's a combined 31 points between the two teams, including one stretch where there were 17 points in a little over 2 minutes, right?
And at that point, that's when we kind of started understanding what this game was going to look like. But I think we also got a sense of the magnitude of the injury that we'd seen. And that's when we really understood what the Seahawks defense was going to be. And I think...
When Bobby Wagner went out?
When Bobby Wagner went out.
So I was driving at this point to the UW game and listening on the radio, and I was not aware that Wagner was out until well after.
What in the hell? Are you kidding me, people?
I'm not saying they didn't say anything about it. I just, for whatever reason,
I mean, the TV didn't broadcast process didn't that talk it was about a serious it for injury. At least a quarter. If Luke Kuechly was not in the game, it would have been the talking point for the entire game. People would have been like, oh, well, Luke Kuechly's out. It's not, the Seahawks defense can't play without him. But Bobby Wagner, Defensive Player of the Year candidate, one of kind of three candidates for Defensive Player of the Year, is out of the game. The Jaguars score touchdowns on three consecutive plays from scrimmage without him out there.
I mean,
no mention of it.
That might have been part of it because there just wasn't very much time to talk about it because they were constantly scoring touchdowns.
There were moments that they could have talked about it. And it did not come up. I mean, to me, Bobby Wagner being questionable and then being ruled out is a huge story. When I saw that, the moment that I saw it was when the Seahawks had just tied the game with the Doug Baldwin touchdown.
Yes.
Which was amazing. Also, getting on that ball, on the fumble.
Yeah.
Tedrick Thompson, I think, with the fumble recovery.
He did have the recovery.
But I saw that Bobby Wagner was questionable to return, which I'm smart enough to know means he's not coming back.
That doesn't necessarily mean that.
And I knew that the Jaguars were scoring quickly.
Did you know that they were going to score then?
No. And this is when the game started, right? We can start at this point. Everything before that didn't matter.
We should talk about the fact that the Seahawks punted from the 38-yard line on their first drive.
I think they thought it was going to be a different game than it ended up being.
If you play for that kind of game, you're going to get that kind of game.
Played for that kind of game, and they got a 30-24 game.
If you play to not score points, you're going to not score points, which they didn't in the first half. And then they had to adjust in the second half. But If you already had some points maybe. Going in.
I mean, the thing to talk about from the first half is that they had a series where they ran the ball well.
That is true.
Which was kind of shocking. And I think when we talk about the Rams coming up, might have been an important series to kind of understand a way to potentially beat this Rams defense.
Although Mike Davis then left the game as well due to injury. It doesn't sound like his is serious. Oh, no. I've broken you. I've broken you.
Okay, so Bobby Wagner goes out. The Jaguars get the long touchdown, right? First play from scrimmage, 75 yards. Unbelievable that we're watching this happen.
I mean, you felt so good about the Seahawks tying the game because it seemed like they were hopelessly behind when they were down 10-0. Like, that was an insurmountable deficit. So to get even as quickly as they did 4.5 minutes later, that, okay, now we got a game here. Now we can just start playing football. And that lasted 11 seconds.
And then the series that comes after that, kind of an awful series, an incomplete pass, or not necessarily an awful series, the incomplete pass to Paul, I'm refreshing myself on that. The incomplete pass to Paul Richardson, you didn't see this. This is a pass that Russell hits every time. One of those passes that he's firing it in. And then McKissick picks up 7 yards, can't pick up the first down. Boom, back to the Jaguars and Jadon effing Mickens, who we knew was something to be afraid of in this game, and the most dangerous type of punt that there is.
Adult long one?
No, a punt that is like, that bounces and comes to the returner, because everything changes with the way that people are responding. All of the tackling assignments change at that point. We've seen Dante Pettis do this to defenses before. If Dante Pettis muffs a punt, you know there's a good chance he's scoring a touchdown.
So after the Seahawks went 3 and out, that's when I left my car and went to walk into Heckhead. So I just read about this on Twitter. I missed this play entirely. And I did not see that coming.
Well, he's
very shocked.
The punt drops. Justin Coleman is chasing after him, kind of falls over. The ball bounces perfectly to Jadon Mickens, who also has a really weird number. I don't like Jadon Mickens' number.
I mean, it's a 85 is a pretty normal number.
He should be like number 12 or something, number 10. He should be a number in the teens.
Anyway, all right.
Returns it to the one. They punch it in with Leonard Fournette right there. Boom! 2 plays from scrimmage in a row that they've scored touchdowns with Bobby Wagner on the bench. So you can't fault Bobby Wagner or the Seahawks defense for this
one either. 3 plays in a row at one point. I mean, I guess because of the fact that the previous play they had scored a touchdown.
Yeah. Okay. There were 3 plays in a row.
Yeah, I guess so. Wow, that is pretty crazy. Back-to-back 1 yard touchdown drives, or 1 play touchdown drives. Yeah, and the Seahawks, like, at that point didn't appear like they were going to be capable offensively of keeping up with those kind of scoring fireworks from the Jacksonville offense. Now, they were in the fourth quarter because all of a sudden receivers started streaking free through the Jacksonville secondary inexplicably. But I guess we can't say it was too late. They still got the ball.
It wasn't too little too late. I mean, okay, so running through that, they get these super long drives that the Jaguars have, and without Bobby Wagner, so they pin them at the 2, KJ Wright goes out, and you're looking at a linebacking core of Michael Wilhoit, DJ Alexander is in there. I mean, like, these are players who should not be playing in this game.
I mean, Wilhoit
DJ Alexander isn't a linebacker. He is a special teams player.
I mean, he is a linebacker as well, but yeah, the value to having him on the roster is primarily as a special teamer.
And then so the Jaguars have these super long drives where you're just like, this isn't the Seahawks defense anymore. This isn't the defense that we've seen for so many years. And literally, the players on the field aren't the players that we've seen for so many years.
I mean, besides the defensive line, Earl Thomas is the only starter you have out there at this point after KJ Wright goes out.
The defensive line did not look good.
It wasn't their best game.
So they had these long drives, and then somehow, I don't even know what's happening. I mean, the amount that I'm starting to kind of check out of the game and think that I'm moving more towards Eagles-Rams, and then it's like, boom, 60 yards to Paul Richardson. Long drive for the Jaguars again. Boom, 70 yards to Tyler Lockett. It's like, what is happening? How did they do this? And then finally, the Seahawks get the defensive stop that they needed for so long, right? Were you watching at this point?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And the decision to pass on
second down. I wasn't as emotional about it as you are, clearly.
I mean, this was a huge series.
But your chances of winning are still very low in this situation.
Oh, I completely disagree with you.
I mean, first off, like, Ben B. posted it on after, if they had they converted the first down on this series that we're going to talk about, their chances of winning would have been 40%.
That's still a pretty good chance of winning, considering that it was 27-10 at one point, and yes, the game looked over. I mean, this was such a Seahawks comeback that, I mean, you have to admire the Seahawks.
It was an every blade of grass performance.
That the Seahawks were able to come back in this game, and also, I'm going to talk about this in a second because I think this was a very impressive Russell Wilson performance.
I do not think so. So that'll be interesting to disagree about.
Okay, so this drive that they had, this stop against the Jaguars, to get the ball back with so much time, plus two timeouts and the two-minute warning, what are you saying to yourself going into that?
I'm saying to myself, you know, they actually could punt the ball and get the ball back here.
Yes.
Is actually what I literally what I said to
him. I had that thought also.
I was watching this with Tim Booth of the AP, and I mentioned that to him.
I mean, which they almost kind of did. I mean, they didn't punt the ball, but they almost had a chance after the turnover on downs. But I'm thinking the Seahawks have everything going for them at this point. When they get that stop.
Not the deficit. That's paying too much attention to momentum here. You're still going against the best passing defense in the NFL.
That's why it was a good Russell Wilson performance, first off. But second off, okay, do you remember the Rams game like 3 years ago where the Seahawks had to fight back and fight back and fight back and they ended up losing it because of the fake deep in Rams territory?
Yes. When the Austin Davis game.
When the Seahawks got that ball, they were down in that game. They were going to score. Jeff Fisher knew it. You knew it. Everybody knew it. And that's why he had to fake it. And that's what was happening in this situation.
I don't think that's a very probabilistic way to view things.
I understand this is, I mean, that's a good Rams defense probably also, but the Seahawks should have scored on the series, and the Jaguars left them this perfect window, something that we could not have possibly conceived when it was 27-10, that they would have the ball down six with two timeouts, with the two-minute warning, plenty of time.
Well, not apparently enough time for Doug Baldwin.
And then this fucking series. It's just like, oh, everything looks so good. And
that's
so
because you're overestimating how things look. Things like this happen.
Okay, hold on.
That's why your odds of winning are still less than 50%.
Things looked good. That's the thing. First down, you have wide open Jimmy Graham. Drops, not a perfect pass necessarily, but a pass that Jimmy Graham should have caught.
Would have been
8 yards on first down and out of bounds. I mean, there's almost no better play to have in that situation. With the cushion that they talked about.
Second down, you do get a 9-yard completion to Doug Baldwin, who chooses to go out of bounds.
Were you angry about this at the time? That's the thing. I'm screaming at the TV, get the first down, Doug. What are you doing?
I wasn't as emotional about this game as you were. I mean, maybe it's because I was watching this in public with a bunch of like media members, but I was not as emotional as you were.
This was a huge drive. I mean, this drive right here, percentage chances of the Seahawks making the playoffs on this drive were enormous. We were talking about like a 20% swing for making the playoffs.
I suppose. It's a 40% chance of a 20% chance, which is 5%.
But you're saying that you're not cheering for things. Like, I don't even understand this argument.
I wasn't as emotional about it. Like, you seem to have been living and dying on every play.
I was living and dying on every play. Yes.
I don't know. But I guess the emotional part of me had already been destroyed by this part of the week.
I mean, look, I knew what was going to happen. But I thought there was a chance that this drive was going to save. So Doug doesn't pick up the first down.
Gets 9 yards.
It has plenty of space too. I don't really understand what was happening. He seemed like he was worried about the clock when there was plenty of time. It wasn't right.
Yes.
It's just like, what are you doing, Doug? If he gets that first down, you can't look at the plays that even happen after that because everything's different with a first down.
But what you do know is still 3rd and 1. You are likely to pick that up. I mean, I think people have pointed it as inevitable that they were going to not pick it up after he went out of bounds. And that's not the case. That's not fair to Doug Baldwin. Doug Baldwin isn't the one who let Russell Wilson be sacked on 3rd and 1.
There was so much time left that I thought there was a good chance that they were going to run the ball on 3rd down.
That would have made some sense. I hadn't considered that.
And I don't know if was Mike Davis. He was not back at this point. J.D. McKissick's probably not the right back to have done it with.
Depends what kind of front they're showing.
This is one of those situations when you would have liked to have had a competent run game.
I mean, first off, you could have just run the ball with Russell Wilson.
I thought there was a very good chance that they did that, that they would just roll Russell out and have him run it and easily pick up the first down and we'd be moving, right? This is a game that Doug Marrone challenged a 3-yard catch. it ended up 30-24.
Future generations will not understand.
Okay, so 4th and 9 all of a sudden. You're like 3rd and 1, feel pretty good. Seahawks are going to pick this up.
Fourth and 9, I kind of thought they should have punted. But you know that the Bill Barnwell rule that usually when you decline to go for it on 4th down, you end up facing a more difficult 4th down later on that you have to go for. So that was the argument against punting.
Yeah, I did not want them to punt in that situation. I thought there was a chance of it, but I didn't want them to. Okay, so Russell Wilson gets sacked, which is really unfortunate in this situation, plus the illegal shift on the play. I thought it was a defensive penalty. I thought it was a defensive holding that was happening. But
everyone in the room thought it was a hold on the Seahawks.
Oh, yeah. There was a chance of that also. So illegal shift, all things considered, is pretty good. 4th down and 9. Was this a cover 0? Did they bring the house with this one?
I don't know. I don't think so.
There was definitely pressure. They were bringing pressure on 4th and 9. Russell Wilson throws it up. On TV, it's an awkward-looking play, right? It seems like maybe there was contact on Doug. Couldn't really tell what happened. It's like, feels like there should be a flag somewhere, and there's nothing. Fox then highlights Paul Richardson being held as he's streaking down the field, which Russell said later was where he was going on the play. It was the type of hold that a defender does when they're like, screw it, I've lost him. I don't want this to be a huge play. I'm just going to hold to give up the 5 yards.
Yes.
And it's not called.
I mean, I don't know if that necessarily was the logic because you're just falling down.
But he held him to be like,
Hold him, or did he just interfere with him because of the fact that he was falling down and that was like his course of falling down?
And he just grabbed somebody. Every time you fall, you just grab at the nearest person. Oh, you might. I don't know. But I'm saying it was the type of play that I think even, who was the defender on the play? Do you know?
I don't.
Even he thought it was going to be called on this play.
People never underestimate the capacity to see things in a light that is favorable to your viewpoint.
No call. More or less game over at that point.
I mean, still the Seahawks could have got the ball back because two-minute warning, this was still on the right side of the two-minute warning plus the two timeouts you had left. Like, they would have gotten the ball back with about a minute 45 left. They would have had terrible field position.
I was hopeful at this point also because DJ Alexander made a play.
Really did. But then a 13-yard run by Leonard Fournette on 3rd and 11. I mean, in a case where, like, kind of you break through that initial wall, there's going to be a big play available probably.
Yeah. If you get through DJ Alexander, there's open space waiting for you. So they get the first down, then the Seahawks start fighting. And I just don't – if this is one thing, I appreciate the defend every blade of grass thing, but attacking people on kneel plays, I'm not okay with.
Yeah, and that's a Michael Bennett specialty. He's always done that. And, yeah, there's no justification for it.
It's going to start a fight almost every time, which – am I right about this? Because there were offsetting penalties. Seahawks called the timeout, I think, on first down. Or they hadn't called a timeout yet. They're offsetting penalties. It's 2nd down, and the Seahawks had a timeout left.
The Seahawks had...
Could they have gotten the ball back if they didn't then subsequently get more penalties, including Pete Carroll running way out onto the field?
Huh.
I think they could have.
Yeah, I guess they could have, yes, because they still had a timeout left, it appears, at the end of the game, and Jacksonville ran their final play at 21 seconds. I didn't watch any of this. I left the UW media room.
It was pretty ugly.
After
it was not great.
First down. Yeah, I mean, I feel, but so because I think it's, I think we need to talk about this because I feel like this is going to overshadow everything that happened in the game. This is going to be the talking point in the media this week is going to be what happened at the end of this game, particularly because of the ugliness between fans in Jacksonville in the end zone and Quentin Jefferson, which I got to tell you, I've moved Jacksonville outside my top 10, or Florida swamp cities.
Wow. I can't believe it's out of the top 10. No, there was footage that Bill Barnwell tweeted of Tyler Lockett getting hit with something when he scored a touchdown. I actually couldn't see the thing being thrown at him.
You can sort of see it fly in. You can't really see it hit him.
Don't throw stuff at players. Like, are you fucking kidding me? Don't throw stuff at players. That's it. Just don't do it. And if you're a fan, do not throw stuff onto the field.
Yeah.
No matter what the situation is, don't throw stuff onto the field. I mean, honestly, Quentin Jefferson was fighting, if we can be honest here, Quentin Jefferson was fighting with the people in the crowd before the thing was thrown. That kind of set him off even more to the point where he tried to climb into the crowd. But it kind of vindicated what Quentin Jefferson did because of the throwing. He would have looked worse in that situation if they hadn't done it.
Yeah. I mean,
don't throw stuff at players.
Look,
these are my grievances. First off, defensive holding should have been called on that Paul Richardson play. Second off,
don't throw stuff at players.
Don't throw. Be a better football city, Jacksonville. Like, really, you're hanging on by a thread.
Look, I don't.
You're Jacksonville.
I don't think that there are actually differences between fans in this way. Like, I don't believe that the Cardinals are the best fans in baseball. Like, look, fans are fans.
When was the last time that Seahawks fans threw something at a player?
I don't know, but I don't think that there was something. There's something unique about Jacksonville fans. First off, you're judging them based on a handful of idiots.
This is. It's a weird thing to happen multiple times in a game. That Tyler Lockett play wasn't at the end of the game, wasn't like really in a chippy situation. He just scored a touchdown.
But if something gets thrown in the field and it doesn't actively hit a player, do you notice it?
I don't know.
Do you know this stuff isn't getting thrown for the crowd?
Your argument that stuff is being thrown all the time and we're not seeing it is a strange argument.
Look, anyway, this also gets back to my theory that why I hate field and court storming. The field is for the player, the court is for the players. The
yes.
Fans are for the fans, and never the twain shall meet.
Yes.
Only wait, bad
so, wait,
things
so are
happen.
Are you anti if Marshawn Lynch is kicked out of the game, him going into the stands and sitting in the stands?
That's a different situation.
Because I'm very pro that.
He has become a fan at that point. I am also very pro that.
Anyway, it was an ugly end of the game. I agree that it's going to overshadow it. But what we should be talking about is, and DVOA is going to love this game in a lot of ways for the Seahawks. Maybe not their defense, but offensively, they're going to love this game. The Seahawks, I don't know. Yards per play were better than Jacksonville. 7 yards per play for the Seahawks, 6.4 for Jacksonville. This was the second most yards that Jacksonville has given up against all season, right? I understand that two of them came on big plays, but those big plays happen. Their defense gave those up.
They will be somewhat discounted by DVOA because at some point DVOA says that it's not necessarily better for you to score a 74-yard touchdown than a 40-yard touchdown. That's just because you happen to be farther back on the field.
But they still scored a touchdown.
Yes, but I'm saying it's not going to be. You're not going to get the full value of the yards.
I mean, the Seahawks offense, all things considered, when you look at it, played pretty well in this game.
And the interceptions also count. Russell Wilson threw 3 interceptions, which is why I don't agree that this was a great game by Russell Wilson.
But you have to look at this in terms of he's playing a historically good Jaguars secondary. You're going to do things, but when you end up throwing for 271 yards and 3 touchdowns in a game, it looks good.
I mean, QBR had him at 51.7, and that, I believe, is adjusted for opponent.
You think that's adjusted for the Jaguars defense?
I think it is, yes.
Interesting. It wasn't a perfect game. They have a very good secondary. But all things considered, this was a pretty good performance by Russell Wilson. I think the Seahawks will move up in offensive DVOA after this game.
He forced some terrible throws in this game. And they were quite costly.
Anyway, it's just a tough game to watch. And then, well, let's talk about arena stuff.
In possibly more optimistic news. So when we last updated you last Tuesday, as we mentioned, at that point, the city council had approved the Key Arena renovation memorandum of understanding 7-1. I should pause to note, I got some flack randomly on Twitter for referring to it as a renovation. The city of Seattle's own discussion of it refers to it alternately as a rebuild and a renovation, but Key Arena rebuild doesn't sound as good to me as like in that context. So I think people understand what I'm saying. Like, I'm not trying to minimize the importance of what's happening here. It will be functionally a new arena that will be being built, but it's still in the same site and still using the same roof. So I think renovation is fair. Anyways, on Wednesday, after that, Mayor Jenny Durkin held a press conference to officially sign the MOU along with Tim Leiwicki from the Elkview Group. And I was in attendance. Jenny Durkin really, she kind of showed out as a Sonics fan at this press conference. She was wearing a Sonics t-shirt that she revealed, and she talked about her memories as a child of following the Spencer Haywood case when he was trying to become eligible to play for the Sonics after he had jumped from the ABA to the NBA. At that point, still ineligible to play in the NBA because his graduating class had not graduated college. That case went all the way to the Supreme Court. I wrote about this for supersonics.com and we'll link this in the post notes, but went all the way to the Supreme Court, won that case, and set the stage for the hardship rule to allow early entry to the NBA.
There we go.
So then also interesting, Tim Leiwicki held a brief press availability afterwards. He said that fans should hold him accountable in terms of getting NBA and NHL franchises to play in this arena. So I asked him the question, all right, so what does that mean? What can they actually expect from you given that you don't control the process of, you know, determining who gets an NHL and NBA team? And his reply is, you know, if we don't hold me to it, if we don't have a team a year from now, you should put me at the top of the roof and let me jump down into the rubble as they're deconstructing this place.
That's a very strange quote.
It was an exceedingly strange quote. Like a simple, yeah, we'll get a team for you in the next year.
I want the Sonics to be back also, but if he doesn't have them back in a year, I don't want him to jump to the roof of Key Arena.
To clarify something I think was a little confusing, when he said one franchise, at least I took it to mean like either an NBA or an NHL franchise,
yes,
not a franchise of both of them. So that leads into Thursday's news, which is that the NHL at its owners' meetings announced that they will accept and consider an expansion bid from Seattle for an NHL franchise with an ownership group, as we've already talked about, of David Bonderman and Jerry Bruckheimer. The expansion fee would be $650 million. They're not definitely giving the Seattle a team, but allowing them to start doing a drive for season tickets. And I would say, even though it's not necessarily just as much as having a shovel in the dirt, to me, it would take this deal kind of falling off the tracks.
The arena deal.
Somehow getting undone for Seattle not to get a team.
I mean, this is kind of the culmination of what you've been talking about.
Yeah, I've been very clear about
this. When there's an arena, no matter where it is, there will be hockey.
The NHL badly wants to be in the city of Seattle.
And I think we'll do very well.
Even though for some reason the league has tried to downplay this and say, oh, no decisions have been made. You know, let's wait and see what the process holds, that sort of thing. Like, they're thirsty to get in Seattle. Like, let's be honest here. Okay. And they made it clear. They're like, Quebec City, which was previously in the expansion bidding with Las Vegas when they only allowed it, awarded one expansion franchise to get to an odd number of teams, 31, with Las Vegas beginning the play this year. They said they're not involved now. Houston, not involved now. It's just Seattle. It's Seattle or bust at this point.
Yes. Which would put them in an even number of teams, kind of the most natural place for them to be. When they awarded Las Vegas a team, left that spot open to get to 32, it made a lot of sense for Seattle to be the 32nd team via expansion, and this is kind of the culmination of that process.
Yeah, and expansion makes more sense, even though there are some franchises that are limbo in the NHL, because you don't have a place for them to play until Key Arena is... the renovation is finished and the building reopens in the fall of 2020. So it makes sense that you could get the expansion process started and take advantage of that time when you don't have a building, but you can start selling season tickets and ramping up towards it. So certainly a very exciting day for NHL fans. Although I would say that, you know, one of my thoughts, you know, we talked last week about how there wasn't seemingly the same enthusiasm as there was when the Soto MOU was signed in 2012. And I thought that the NHL announcement might do it, but I don't know. I mean, obviously the people that I follow on Twitter and follow online are disproportionately NBA biased. But I don't know if I saw necessarily that level of excitement out there in the city as a whole because of this.
I saw some of it.
You think so?
Yeah, I know hockey fans who are pretty excited about it, especially the Deadspin story, which kind of laid it out as Seattle's basically getting hockey.
Yeah, I mean, I think hockey fans are excited. My question is whether casual fans in Seattle are excited.
I think they will be.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is still not a tangible announcement, but it's one step closer to that.
I mean, I think hockey will do exceptionally well in Seattle.
So I think then, you know, taking some of the wind out of the sails of that announcement was the comment from NBA Commissioner Adam Silver at his media availability before the NBA's games in Mexico City on Thursday, the first one of which was on Thursday night. So he was asked, there was a vote in Seattle this week about renovating Key Arena. Is the plan to do that adequate to attract an NBA team in the future? And Silver's reply is, in terms of the revamping or renovation of Key Arena, shouts to Silver for also using the term renovation, we have not been involved.
You didn't say revamping or renovation.
I did not say renovating. We have not been involved in any way with those plans. We, of course, are very aware of them, but the specifications to house an NBA team are well known, published, and available to any city looking to build or refurbish an existing arena. So it's hard for me to imagine that they would make that investment in Seattle and not create an NBA-ready building. But again, we have not been directly involved in those discussions.
So what does that mean?
So I don't know. I mean, you can read this a few ways. The kind of more sympathetic to the Oakview and the Key Arena renovation viewpoint, which was expressed by my friend Brian Robinson on Twitter, is that, look, he's not going to say anything about this, you know, not going to say anything that seems to be an endorsement of Seattle until the NBA actually has a team that is ready to move here or to put an expansion team here.
Especially because this is the most likely would be relocation.
At this point, yes. Why would you get people's hopes up? Why would you also, you know, create fear-mongering among teams that are currently in teams? And I think that's a valid point. But at the same time, you know, I've talked to people in the league, and there seems to be a sense that Silver is delivering a message that's more than just that, that there are some concerns here.
Interesting.
One of the replies I got a lot on Twitter was, wait, so has Oakview been lying about keeping Adam Silver and the NBA appraised of what they're doing here or being in communication with them? And let's be clear. Adam Silver never says they were not in communication with them. He says, we have not been involved in any way with the plans.
Yes.
Which is a different thing entirely. But it's certainly not an affirmation that this makes sense for the NBA. And I would say, as much as everyone has fixated on him talking about, you know, the specifications to house a team are well known, you know, hard for me to imagine they would make that investment and not create an NBA-ready building. It's not just about the physical layout of the building, which is maybe a little bit of a concern because of the fact that the footprint of that site is still limited by you know, what you have to work with in the Seattle, what was the Seattle Center Coliseum grounds, it's going to be a bigger arena than Key Arena is now. And the size, the footprint is a major issue, but it's not still going to be as large as the Soto Arena would be or most other buildings in the NBA. The counterpoint is that, you know, generally the trend lately has been towards smaller buildings, a little bit more intimate. So, you know, I can see both sides of that. But I think, again, the main concern is this deal going to be financially viable for an NBA team? And Tim Iwicki has maintained that, yes, it will. The experts who have talked to the Seattle City Council and appraised them before this vote maintained it will. I got to say, I'm still skeptical. Because first, this is where, like, the physical dimensions for an NHL arena and an NBA arena, the NHL needs bigger space. That was the problem with Key Arena for the NHL. They didn't build it big enough to fit it.
That's
an
why
NHL
the, I'm honestly like curious why the NHL hasn't moved here.
Oh, that's why. Barry Ackerley did not want an NHL team to compete with the Sonics. He actively sabotaged an attempt to get an NHL expansion team here in the 90s.
Wow.
Which, by the way,
Barry Ackerley is like the Sonic. You know, Sonics fans, we've got Schultz. It's like a hockey fan said, Barry Ackerley.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it created some long-term problems, let's say, in terms of the planning. But so from a physical standpoint, hockey actually needs more space. But from a financial standpoint, look, we learned that the expansion cost is $650 million. If there's expansion in the NBA, it's going to be minimum double that and probably triple that. It's probably going to be close to $2 billion to get a team.
Interesting. Here.
So the finances you need to make a successful NBA team are very different from the finances you need to make a successful NHL team.
Yes.
And that is, I think, where the concern lies.
So you think the concern lies because any potential owner, because that's one of the issues, and that might be what Adam Silver is alluding to and why they haven't been involved in the process. There isn't an owner. There isn't a team for sale, right? There's technically no team for sale right now in the NBA.
Well, I mean, technically Memphis is for sale, but that's a closed bidding process.
For sale to the minority owners.
Yes.
You're saying that both the, if you were to purchase the team, right? Let's say that a hypothetical owner, we have no idea who they could be, would pay both the fee for the team, which would be in the billions, plus a relocation fee in the billions?
In that case, yes. Assuming you're moving an existing team. So to justify that expense.
It could cost $4 billion to move a team to Seattle.
No, I don't think it would be that. I mean, I think it would be in the range of $2 billion. Because if you're buying a smaller market team, that cost will probably be a little lower than if you're getting an expansion team or buying a big market team like Houston.
So you think it could be something like $1 billion for the team, and these are insane amounts of money we're talking about,
$1 billion
relocation fee.
No, I don't think the relocation fee would be that high. But I'm saying between the cost of the team, the relocation fee, and then getting out of your lease, which would be part of this, I think, yes. Yeah, at that point, you're talking about approximately $2 billion.
Okay.
So you've got to be making a lot of money to justify that.
Yes.
Is what I'm saying. And that's where I think the finances could be different for an NBA team than an NHL team.
But Oakview, I mean, to argue against you, Oakview has said they're willing to look at if there's the right owner, including them in on the arena deal.
Yeah, but I'm saying the NHL group is going to be included as well. If you make them equal partners, that might not work as well for the NBA team as the NHL team.
And the NHL ownership has no interest in hockey or probably the finances.
In the NBA?
In the NBA, yes, sir.
I mean, they've said that Bonnerman is a part owner of the Celtics. We have not heard any public comment from him indicating he's interested in owning an NBA team as well.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think the other question, so after I tweeted this comment, I heard from a lot of Soto fans.
Yes.
A lot more Soto fans than we heard from, sadly, at the city council meetings. And they're frustrated. They're angry about this process. And I'm sympathetic too. I understand that anger. But I think you have to channel it in a positive direction.
Okay.
So if you're someone who is a believer in the Soto sites is the best chance of bringing the NBA to Seattle, I think first off, the thing you need to know is, look, it's too late to relitigate this Key Arena decision. That vote has been cast. Unless something crops up unforeseen between now and next October, Key Arena is going to get renovated. So I think your focus needs to be on the two arena solution. And specifically getting city council to approve the street vacation of Occidental and Avenue to allow Chris Hansen and their group to build if they are able to successfully get an NBA team.
And is there still a chance that they're going to vote on this?
I mean, nothing as far as I know is scheduled, but, you know, Jenny Durkin again reiterated in that press conference on Wednesday, she said that she has met with the Soto Arena team. and express to them that nothing in the MLU prevents them from building an arena. As we've talked about, it would, the exclusivity clause would prevent them, as it appears, from getting the admissions tax waiver that they have sought as part of the funding plan for this. But the door has been left ajar, at the very least. And if you come to the city council and the mayor with an NBA team, if you're able to purchase an NBA team at some point, that could change the equation dramatically. But I think the key thing is to keep up the pressure on city council to approve the street vacation, because that's what's going to potentially change in the future. The Key Arena versus Soto, that's not going to change right now.
Okay, which we'd be fine with. Look, nobody has, people, Sonics fans who are in support of the Soto option are not necessarily against Key Arena.
And definitely not against hockey. I mean, I think a lot of us did like the idea of renovating Key Arena into a music-only venue, as the Soto Arena group had proposed. But even if that doesn't happen, that's fine.
I mean, I'm excited for hockey.
And yeah, I mean, that's one of the unfortunate things that happened, is kind of pitting hockey against the Sonics.
I want all of it. All the things. But so you're saying that if Chris Hansen all of a sudden turns up and owns an NBA team, that'll be a big deal.
Yeah, it changes the discussion. I mean, that's been one of the big concerns that's been raised over and over again. And I think one of the reasons that the city council thought that, I think believes that Key Arena is a better path towards getting an NBA team, is the notion that it's going to be impossible to get a team without having an arena. Mm-hmm. It's kind of this weird, like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? What comes first, the arena or the team?
How has that worked generally in other cities?
I think generally you build the arena first and get the team later.
That has worked.
Oklahoma City, that was the case. Memphis, that was Memphis, I guess maybe they built it later. So Memphis, they got the team and then built the arena.
Also, these were under very different finances, too.
Yes.
I mean, both of those situations, the amount of money that Oklahoma paid, and I'm assuming Memphis paid also for the team, is nowhere near the astronomical amounts that NBA teams are going for now.
Oh, no. I mean, obviously, Clay Bennett now, in hindsight, that Oklahoma City group got a huge steal getting that organization.
Yeah, they got a huge steal. you're right. But so that could be something that changes it. And the admissions tax, we have no idea how big of a portion that is for Chris Hansen.
Right.
They hypothetically could make the finances work without it.
Definitely possible.
Especially if they're owning the arena, they own the land around it. You know, they could potentially, there are other...
Which is why they have maintained that they're not giving up. So I think that should be the attitude among fans who are pro Soto as well. Don't give up.
The only thing that's dead here is them getting the admissions tax.
Based on the exclusivity clause, as it's currently written, yes.
Nothing else is dead.
As far as I know.
Interesting.
Huh. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think altogether, we have to be positive and say this is good news.
I mean, certainly, the silver comment was discouraging, because I guess what I should say is it stoked really the fear here, which is that we went through all this trouble. We're going to rebuild Key Arena, renovate Key Arena, and we're still not going to get the Sonics back.
Are there other cities out there that are competing for NBA teams right now?
Not actively. I mean, Louisville is always in discussion. Anaheim gets mentioned.
These are like second-tier cities, though, in a lot of ways. These are smaller markets.
Clearly, Seattle would be the premier destination for an NBA team if one were available.
I mean, does Louisville have people with billion-dollar money out there looking to buy a team and move it there?
I don't know about that.
I don't think that they're on the same wavelength. And there's still probably issues that are going to arise. You've mentioned the Memphis ownership. There are conversations that are going to happen around ownership with franchises in the future. And Seattle has to be in the place to position themselves, but kind of does solve, you know, Key Arena solves an issue for the Seattle City Council, but Seattle could solve an issue for the NBA.
Yeah.
Okay, so what about a basketball team that is playing in Seattle, had a huge win this week?
Yeah, so the Huskies, as we mentioned earlier, go into the Sprint Center in Kansas City, built by Tim Lawiecki, of all people.
There we go.
No NBA or NHL franchise there. But they do have Kansas basketball, and Kansas has now lost three games there in the past year, including a 74-65 loss to the Huskies on Wednesday. This was mind-blowing. I mean, if you listen back, we posted this on Twitter, like the audio of us discussing this game. Like, you with the... So you're telling me there's a chance.
Wait, did you post that? Just that snippet?
Our loyal listener, Ben B., put it together.
Oh, yeah. Well.
Yeah. We didn't think there was really a chance.
No.
And somehow they won. I still don't quite understand how the Huskies won this game. I mean, you know, the zone you would think would be a big part of that. It's weird because of the fact that they had previously played Syracuse in their game before this. One of the things that got a lot of credit that Mike Hopkins pointed to is the fact that the Seahawks at the Seahawks. The Huskies had, I'm sorry, I was looking at a Seahawks page. The Huskies had tweaked their zone so as to kind of be more aggressive, taking away the three-pointer. And he credited playing a lot of teams early in the season who would like to take a lot of threes, including going back to St. Martin's in the exhibition
game.
There
we go.
We thought that was such a big disaster. The Huskies struggled with St. Martin's, but maybe it was actually a useful test, as it turned out. And so in this game, Kansas, which has been very effective shooting from three-point range this season, went 5 of 20 on threes. The Huskies, by contrast, went 9 of 21 on threes, including 5 threes, as many as the entire Kansas team from Matisse Thybulle.
Amazing. I mean, I saw basically none of this game. Who stood out for the Huskies?
I mean, Thybulle was great, but it was really a team effort. I mean, David Crisp, even though he didn't, like, 10 points on 3 of 9 shooting doesn't sound that good, but he really ran the team better than I think we've ever seen him do so, had 7 assists in this game. But it was really a lot of, you know, a lot of players. Noah Dickerson with a double-double and 5 assists, incredibly. Sam Timmons played quite well in his 18 minutes of action. His size, I think, was really important. Hamir Wright played 27 minutes off the bench, much more than action than he'd seen. You know, a really good game for Jalen Noel with 17 points. And it was a little of everything. And then obviously, defensively, we talked about Devontae Graham in his case at that point for Player of the Year. Devontae Graham goes 1 of 8 from the field in this game, 1 of 5 from 3, and scores 3 points. So really the only success they had was LeGerald Vick operating kind of the middle of the zone at the free throw line, scored 28 points and had 7 assists. Other than him, Kansas couldn't really get much going in this one.
Kind of amazing. I mean, the thing that you have to compare it to is you look back at Sark's first year. We talked about this last week, and picking up that victory right, I think this was his fourth game or something, yeah, against USC, who came into this powerhouse, right? Pete Carroll is their coach, his mentor at USC. They're this powerhouse that come in, the Huskies win this improbable game, the fans storm the field. It's a terrible situation that fans are on the field.
Exactly. But that was at least at home. Like, you can see making trouble for a team at home. To do this in what is, if in every sense, a road game.
And then what happened? Okay, so first off, the positive. No matter what happens the rest of the season, the Huskies have a signature win. There is a signature win of the Mike Hopkins era already through 9 games.
And something to capture national attention. I mean, it was just amazing seeing this repeatedly on SportsCenter and, like, how much play it got to beat the number 2 team in the country. It was beat.
We don't want Matisse Thybulle to go out early, which I don't think will happen. But no matter what happens for the rest of the year, people are going to remember this performance from Matisse Thybulle.
So here's the bad. People suddenly thought that, like, UW is, like, this great team. It's like, guys, oh, like 3 days ago, they were down in the second half to Nebraska Omaha. Like, they didn't overnight become a juggernaut, like a Pac-12 contender, just because they beat Kansas. And guess who was there to remind us of that?
So that's what I was going to say. The Huskies, under Coach Sark in his first year, they beat USC at home, feel good, were excited. I think they were ranked in the top 25 for the first time in a very long time. Then the next week, they travel to Stanford, and waiting for them is Heisman Trophy runner-up Toby Gearhart, and they get destroyed by Stanford. And what happens to the Huskies on Sunday?
Well, it's even worse, because it's a rival coming to town. For the first time since, as we noted last week, the Adam Morrison era, Gonzaga in the resumption, the series that resumed last year, and bringing a lot of fans to Hackett, a ton of fans to Hackett, who became very vocal as they pulled away in a 27-point victory that was every bit as lopsided as that score would indicate.
So I was kind of watching this game on and off. The takeaway that I had was that I felt like Gonzaga was really lucky in this game. Would you agree with that assessment?
No.
Okay. Gonzaga's just good.
I mean, so it was interesting. Like, they had kind of the same thing where in the first half, they were struggling to shoot from the perimeter. They were 3 of 13 on threes. Then in the second half, they were not struggling for the perimeter. They shot 7 of 15 on threes. And UW actually scored pretty well, I think, in the second half of this game. Let's see here. They have about 1 point per possession in the I guess that's for the full game. So that's not bad. They shot 50% in the second half, and they shot 50% from three themselves, and just made no ground up whatsoever because Gonzaga kept scoring time after time.
It was 14 at the half, right? 13 or 14 at the half. Yeah. And I had the game off for like a minute into the second half, and boom, it's a 20-point game. I mean, it was instant that Gonzaga went up, and I was like, game's over.
Yeah, they hit back-to-back threes. Gonzaga scored 133 points per 100 possessions in this game.
Jesus Christ.
And again, like overall, the three-point percentage wasn't great. It was 36% pretty much average. They really dominated in transition. They got to the free throw line and shot 81% at the free throw line. Gonzaga's just a really good team. Like, they had a bad game against Villanova. I don't know exactly what happened to them at MSG on Tuesday. They got a great game from Zach Norvell, a freshman that we didn't talk about, who adds kind of an athletic dimension for them, scored 21 points here, which
is he the one I'm from assuming is a Washington career State? High. No.
He is not. That is Cody Kispert, who didn't play that much and didn't play that well in this game. And then Jonathan Williams kind of dominated on the inside. He had 23 points, 12 boards. I mean, they're good.
That guy, he's the lefty, right?
He is the lefty.
He just like casually shoots a three, and you're like, how did that go in?
I don't know that he shot a lot of threes.
But there was one play that I remember where he just like pulled up casually for a three, knocks it down. Like, this game's over.
I think you're thinking of someone else. He did not attempt a three in this game.
Maybe I guess that was somebody else. I don't
exclusively
know.
Exclusively operating in the paint. So, yeah, and then I think specifically, well, it was a kind of a reality check for the Huskies in general. It was specifically a reality check for Jalen Nowell, who came off the bench. I still haven't found out why he came off the bench in this game, but had 11 points on 4 of 10 shooting.
I had the Yule log on TV. I have no idea who's shooting.
Matisse Thybulle, by the way, followed up that great performance at Kansas, 5 points on 2 of 7 shooting, although he had 4 steals. I mean, Matisse Thybulle, he's not going to be a consistent offensive presence, no matter how much you want him to, and you really want him to. It's just not the case. That's not who he is as a player.
What about coming up for this Husky basketball team?
So they're taking most of the week off for, I assume, finals week at UW. And then next Sunday they will host Loyola Marymount, who comes in ranked number 230 in the Pomeroy rankings, but did lose by just 4 at Oregon State. Their best win so far is Incarnate Word, a team whose nickname...
The Cardinals.
Yeah. They are in the bottom 20 in terms of sending opponents to the free throw line, so I'd expect a lot of Noah Dickerson free throws in this game. They're surprisingly number 3 in offensive rebounding in the country, but they've struggled offensively with turnovers. This is a game the Huskies should win pretty easily. They've got 2 more of these in terms of the non-conference games against really low-ranked opponents.
And Carney Ward crashes the boards.
Do they?
You said they're number 3 in offensive rebounding.
No, Loyola Marymount does.
Oh.
They beat Incarnate Word. That was their best win.
Oh.
So UW would be a notch up from that, a step up from that, it's safe to say.
Incarnate Word has not beaten Kansas, right?
They have not beaten Kansas.
So there's Loyola Marymount and then a couple of easier games before Pac-12 play.
Yeah, I mean, they'll have Montana, which is a little more difficult. But, you know, 2 of 3 should be pretty comfortable wins before they ease into Pac-12 play.
Okay, so looking at this right now as it stands, you have to say the first couple of months of the Mike Hopkins era have been really good, all things considered. Not necessarily write the name Hopkins on your chest and show up to the Husky game good.
That's part of student section fandom. And it was awesome to see the dog pack full. Like, the upper level, the upper ring of the arena, which is single game tickets, virtually all Gonzaga fans and the famous cousin.
She's all alone at the Gonzaga fans.
She really was. But the student section showed out. Also, Spencer Hawes was in attendance.
Oh, there we go.
There were so many Hawes there.
I saw him with Steve Hawes and
his uncle and his dad. I think we're all there. And possibly his mom.
Man, Spencer, does he play? Is he doing anything?
No, he's
not living the life.
Yeah.
Man.
Just making $7 million this year from the, or I guess his salary got stretched. So he gets like $2.5 million, I think, this year.
I saw that and I was like, Spencer Hawes is living good right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's Christmas time. Feeling good out there. All right. What about the Husky women?
UW women lost at Boise State pretty badly this week earlier, 85-62, but came back home to beat Grand Canyon 79-65.
The Antelopes.
They also will take the week off for finals before traveling to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina to take on North Carolina, who is not as good as you would think. They're 68th in the sacred rankings.
A neutral site.
So still probably a game the Huskies, young Huskies, will struggle with, but maybe a chance for them to pull off their own upset of a big name. Quickly Husky football. UW picked up 3 commitments this over the weekend. 2 of them players from Utah. 4-star lineman Sam Taimani, who can either play offensive line or defensive line. We'll see where he ends up at UW. And then 3-star linebacker MJ Tafisi. And then also 3-star defensive lineman Zion Tupuola Fatui.
Yes. There's some Pac-12 names here. Very excited about Sam Taimani, especially being able to play both offense and defense.
I mean, you don't care about anything else but linemen when it comes to recruiting.
I told you the only things that I care about, if I could rank what I want the Huskies to sign, offensive line, offensive line, offensive line, offensive line.
No quarterbacks in there?
No. Quarterbacks are easy. They've signed two excellent quarterbacks this year, which kind of leads into what we'll talk about next. But picking up good offensive line or defensive line recruits is very exciting and a huge thing for a program like UW to do, to be able to compete at that highest level.
You want to build from the inside out. I think that's a good way to build. As you alluded to, the Huskies will be losing their backup quarterback this year. KJ Curtis Samuels, who has been the backup to Jake Browning the last couple of years, has decided to take a grad transfer for his fifth year of eligibility. He'll graduate in the spring and be immediately eligible. I've heard Oregon State thrown out as a possibility.
Oh, really?
That would be interesting if he reunited with Jonathan.
I'm excited
Spinner.
For KJ Curtis Samuels. Yeah.
He's served the program well, deserves the opportunity to go somewhere and play. This is the very best to me of the grad transfer situation.
Yeah.
The very worst being someone who transfers to one school, to another school, and then goes to a third school because of the fact that they've graduated from the second school.
Wait, that happens?
That happens a lot. Mike Mosher, you remember, who almost ended up at UW and then ended up at Oregon. That's a frequent.
Yeah, but like I mentioned, two quarterbacks coming in from this class. It totally makes sense for KJ Curtis Samuels to transfer here. I mean, it was nice to have him around.
I don't know that they're a big factor in it. I mean, I think it's really just more like you're not going to play because Jake Browning's going to start next year, obviously, yeah. And this is your last chance to play.
Yeah. So he has an opportunity to potentially start next year. I'm excited for him.
All right. That's probably wraps up Husky sports. And it's time for a segment that we'll see if it becomes a fixture. It might just be a one-time thing.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances.
Don't burn yourself.
I got a lot of problems with you people. Now,
we got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
All right. You know how on the internet people often confuse the word traitor for traitor?
It's a meme, but okay. Yeah.
At least the kind of people who are likely to call other people traitors for, say, tweeting before the Seahawks game that they're going to lose often mix those up. So now the joke, the meme, if you will, is to say traitor when this happens instead of traitor. Well, I'm here to tell you that with Jerry DePota, the terms are indistinguishable. Sure, it was funny the last two winters when DePota was making a trade seemingly every other day. He was even self-aware about it. He was in on the joke or the meme. But enough is enough. At some point, these trades aren't remaking a franchise into his own vision the way it was when Pete Carroll and John Schneider turned over the Seahawks roster during their first year in Seattle. Instead, they often seem to be trades for trade's sake. The man can't quit trading. And in the past week, his trades again proved costly.
So excited. I just love this.
Caught up in the Shohei Ohtani sweepstakes. And I was guilty of that too. But I'm not a highly paid MLB general manager. DePota traded away three of the Mariners' remaining actual prospects, partially to get D. Gordon, but also to add $2 million in international pool money the M's could offer Ohtani. Those trades got our hopes up, but did they help the Mariners sign him? More like no Ohtani. So now they've got even fewer prospects in the farm system and some more bonus money to, I don't know, sign some other prospects they can trade away, I guess. I'd rather have the players the Mariners traded away. Now, you know me. I don't believe in tanking. The M's are right to try to win now. That's only fair to their fans. But that doesn't mean you can take your eye off long-range planning as a general manager and gut the entire farm system. That's your freaking job is long-range planning. Jerry DePoto doesn't seem to care about the Mariners' future besides whether it allows him to make more trades. And to me, that means he's a traitor.
I just love your hot take is that Jerry DePoto is addicted to trading. This is my favorite Mariners hot take yet.
Is it?
I think so. That Jerry DePoto is addicted. So, you diagnosing Jerry DePoto is addicted to trading.
Might as well face it. You're addicted to trades.
So ridiculous. Okay, so Ohtani. First off, we forgot this as far as one of the bad things that happened this week. I mean, the amazing thing about Ohtani is that I was describing this to you. I wish that there was an actual percentage chance of, I don't know if this actually is floating around on the internet. Let's say the day before Shohei Ohtani is going to sign with the team, the Mariners' chances of making the playoffs are 20%, right?
Okay.
Then he signs with the Angels, and their chances with him might have been 35%. Then he signs with the Angels, and their chances of making the playoffs go down to, let's say, 5%, right? Doesn't that seem about right?
First off, their chances with him were 100%.
1,000,000%. Infinity percent. Because they're already in the division with the World Series winners, and they're going to be in the division with... I mean, first off, it'll be fun from watching the other team perspective in the ALS.
I now return to my regularly scheduled not caring about baseball. It was a fun couple days there where I was in on the Shohei Ohtani thing, but no, back to not caring.
But being in a division with the team, with Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani, and the current World Series champions, it's not a great place to be in. But also, what happened this week was Giancarlo Stanton did not get traded to the Giants, did not get traded to the Cardinals.
Those are teams in the NL.
He's coming to the AL. And speaking of traders... Derek Jeter trades Giancarlo Stanton to the AL. I mean, the Mariners, but like, honestly, maybe Jerry DePoto should get interested in trading current major league players for prospects, because that's what the Mariners need to do at this point.
You have had a Mariners should take hot take in there. I mean, I think it may be time to run that back. But he went the opposite direction because they did trade for D. Gordon last week.
So I still think this is a good trade. Look, we'll see what happens. It's not my money. Who cares? No, it's not even necessarily that big of a money play.
But they traded for D. Gordon, a past Gold Glover, I believe at second base, correct? to play center field. He didn't win a Gold Glove at shortstop, right? He won it at second base, right?
No, he won a Gold Glove at short. Oh, maybe that's Silver Slugger.
That would make more sense. He's like a really good hitter for a shortstop or a really good defender for a second baseman. So they've decided to play him at neither of those positions. Since they already have players.
And it doesn't seem like they really communicated with him that well. The letter from his agent was like...
I haven't seen this letter.
You haven't seen? There's a letter from his agent that's like, D. Gordon's a professional, so he'll do whatever they ask of him, but he's not happy about playing this.
Oh, great.
You always love letters from the agent when you're trading for players, but D. Gordon's a good hitter.
At no point did it say, that's your freaking job.
That's your freaking job. D. Gordon offensively was worth 3 wins last year, which was pretty good. In the past, he's been worth 3.5.
But again, that's in contrast to shortstops, right?
No, I don't think so. You know, you think offensive war is by position?
Yes.
Oh, well, shit.
That was a big thing with Ohtani, because like they have to adjust it for when he's not pitching.
No, I still think D. Gordon is a pretty good player unto himself.
He's a useful player. I mean, he's not a horrible player. It's just the cost of his salary plus the prospects he gave up to get him.
I mean, he doesn't add a ton of power or anything, but at the front end of the lineup, he'll be a pretty good player. Like, the Mariners lineup going into next year is not going to be bad. The problem is they have no pitching, and they also have no pitching prospects.
To the extent that I'm going to see some baseball games when I'm at your house next summer.
Uh-huh. I don't watch a lot of baseball either.
Baby fantasy genius probably will. I'm excited about the fact that the Mariners have a base stealer, because I am not, like, in basketball and in football, I am most entertained by seeing the statistical way to play. In baseball, that is not true at all. I want stolen bases like crazy. I asked you, like, why doesn't Ohtani steal bases? And you were like, because it's not a good thing to do. And I was like, screw that.
You want players who
Let's go steal some bags.
Here's what you want.
That's my hot take.
Players who don't really slug, don't get on base all of that no, well, I want but them to steal a lot of bases.
Yeah, I want them to get on base.
D. Gordon
That's what
D. Gordon
maximizes
is
their opportunity to score bases.
Okay, how about this? Players who have pretty good batting averages, but not that great on base percentages.
Yeah.
D. Gordon is your kind of guy.
All right.
And he's going to be playing center field. It'll be fun. It'll be a fun experiment. I'm sure he'll excel at it.
We've talked way too much about baseball.
All right. Who cares?
The Sounders.
What? We still have to talk about them?
It was really depressing because we were very clear on this podcast last week that we thought it was going to be a totally different game than last year's MLS Cup. And it turned out it was, because Toronto was able to actually score some goals.
I mean, it was a very similar MLS Cup for the Sounders.
I just don't get it. Like, why couldn't they possess the ball?
It was cold?
It was very cold. That is true. Which, one of the takeaways from the Sounders, very clearly after this game, was, hey, what if we played one of these games, but we had it at home in Seattle, instead of having to come to friggin' Toronto in December every single year? And look, credit Toronto FC. They were a very good team. They were the best team in the MLS from start to finish. They got the treble with the Canadian championship. So a historic treble, I'm supposed to call it. So kudos to them.
It's but Canadian championship, come on.
It was a pretty crappy game for the Sounders. And Ladero in particular was just not there. I don't know if it doesn't get that cold in Argentina if he's not used to that. But
really, the whole attack in general, I mean, there were some shots on goal. I saw shots on goal.
To shots on goal. Oh. Here's to shots on goal.
It won't get men in blazers here next summer, but there were shots on goal.
Yeah.
Clint Dempsey didn't really do much.
He was okay.
Offensively, it's Victor Rodriguez. Did we even hear? Did he touch the ball in this game?
Don't think so. Jovan Jones wasn't that involved in his last game as a Sounder.
Was Jovan Jones not being involved in the offense at all until like the 90th minute? It looked pretty good from that point.
Yeah. There wasn't enough stoppage time in this game. That's a grievance.
There's never enough stoppage times. Look, the grievance is soccer. Stop the clock. Are you kidding me? Running clock? Ridiculous.
So the MLS season being as long as it is, they waste no time in getting going with the offseason. The Sounders today, one day after the MLS Cup, had to submit their list of protected players for the expansion draft, which notably includes Osvaldo Alonso, who did not play in the MLS Cup. I think the logic there being that his salary is expensive enough. He takes up a DP spot. Probably LAFC will not be interested in drafting him. More realistically, I think possibilities, Harry Shipp was left unprotected, and then younger reserves, Tony Alfaro and Tyler Miller, who had a pretty good performance, in the first leg of the Western Conference Finals against the Houston Dynamo. LAFC can select up to one player from each team, up to a maximum of five players total in the expansion draft on Tuesday. And immediately after that, free agency will begin. Two Sounders will be free agents. Brad Evans, who barely played this year because of a series of injuries, and probably that brings his career as one of the last original Sounders to an end. And if so, a toast to Brad Evans. That is a handsome man.
Oh, love that Brad Evans.
And Lamar Nagel, also a free agent. I think a more realistic chance that Lamar Nagel could end up back in a Sounders uniform. Probably he'll have to go to another team and then return for like a sixth time.
I like it.
To the Sounders. So the other thing that's coming up for the Sounders, a week from Monday, the CONCACAF Champions League draw. The round of 16 for the CONCACAF Champions League, which the Sounders are in by virtue of winning the 2016 MLS Cup. Now, there's a year lag in this tournament, which previously was played the following summer. The round of 16 will take place starting next February 20th. That is 7 weeks from right now. I mean, we joke about
February
this.
February 20th is 7 weeks from right now?
February 20th Jesus is 7 weeks from right now.
It's basically February.
Yeah, that checks out. We joke about how long the MLS season is, but we joke about it because we are kidding on the square. That is so accurate how long the MLS season is and how short the MLS offseason is. Because they're going to start trading much before that. Like, they're going to play some friendlies. Like, they're going to be gone for like 4 weeks and then they're reporting for training camp again.
Damn.
The MLS season is weird.
So here's what we know about the Sounders.
What do we know about the Sounders?
Is that they most likely will start next season looking very similar to what they are right now.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess we should go through this. So, you know, Alonso being taken in the expansion draft would be a pretty significant change. Barring that, and barring some trades or unlikely defections, like the only real change you're going to have probably at the start of the season is Nuhu replacing Jovan Jones at left back.
And Nuhu played a lot this year also.
Yeah, I mean, the real loss there is the strategic flexibility to play both Nuhu and Jovan Jones together, which is a good lineup for them.
The other thing that we know about the Sounders, and this is looking way too far in the future, is that by the end of next year, they may look like a very different team. But the off seasons in the MLS are very short. Rosters don't change over that much. Rosters change a lot more during the epic MLS season.
I mean, they did have some important additions last offseason, most notably Will Bruin, who ended up on the protected list because he's become kind of a core player for the Sounders. But
did not mention his name at all during the MLS Cup. Not even sure he played.
But Will Bruin, he's the kind of player who requires good service into the box to be a factor. No,
and that wasn't that Will Bruin's fault.
So, you know, I mean, maybe there will be a targeted addition or two like that. But I think they probably want to give this core of players a chance to play from the start of the season. So we'll see if they add any kind of young attacking players with an eye towards Clint Dempsey's eventual possible departure, is he'll again be in the final season of his contract. But, you know, for now, I don't expect major changes.
All right.
All right, so let's wrap it up by previewing the Seahawks next Sunday in a battle for the NFC West division lead with the Los Angeles Rams. both teams coming off loss, and the Seahawks trying to sweep the season series against the Rams, who they beat in LA earlier this year, the win that is single-handedly keeping them in the NFC West discussion.
That win was very important. So quickly, taking a look at what this means via 538's ELO ratings. So right now, the Seahawks with a 58% chance of making the playoffs, 46% chance of winning the division.
Wait, really? 46? I think ELO is much lower on the Rams than, for example, DVOA is.
DVOA loves the Rams.
Loves the Rams.
Lost a DVOA championship today. If the Seahawks were to win that game, they all of a sudden are up to an 80% chance to make the playoffs. Pretty good chance, 4 out of 5 times. And a 70% chance to win the division.
Wow.
Things all of a sudden looking very good for the Seahawks if they can win this game. The entire season, I don't mean to overstate the magnitude of this football game. The entire season comes down to this game.
Yeah, I mean, if they win this game, they just have to match the Rams' record over the last two games to win the NFC West. If they lose this game, all of a sudden, your best-case scenario finishing 10-6 and having to worry about finishing ahead of Atlanta, who can finish 10-6 as the tiebreaker, Green Bay, who can finish 10-6 and as the tiebreaker. I mean, things are getting dark at that point.
If the Seahawks lose this game, we have to consider the very real possibility that their playoff streak is going to be over.
Not just the very real possibility, the probability, right? Did you do the percentages if they lose?
The Seahawks.
You didn't even want to consider that possibility.
If the Seahawks lose the game, their chances of making the playoffs fall to 20%, 19%, 2% chance of winning the division.
Whew. Yeah, so this is a pretty important game. I think that's fair to say. The last matchup, the Rams actually outgained the Seahawks 7.5 yards per play to 5.3 yards per play, which was undermined somewhat by the fact that they had 5 turnovers in that matchup. Still, a really impressive performance by the Seahawks defense against what was, at the time, a seemingly juggernaut offense. Now it's become clear that the Rams' best unit is their defense, but their offense is still good nonetheless.
I just really have a hard time seeing that happen on Sunday.
Really? You're pessimistic? Okay. I mean, Jared Goff, I feel like, he's not been exposed since then, but I think we've realized the limitations of Jared Goff at this point. Like, people aren't talking about him as an MVP candidate anymore like they were through the first couple weeks of the season. He's fifth in DVOA, but he's down to 16th in QBR, like basically league average, which, as we discussed at that point, kind of reflects the fact that this Rams offense gets an unusual proportion of its yards after the catch. It's, you know, getting the ball to their playmakers, notably Todd Gurley and Sammy Watkins, and letting those guys make plays in space.
I suppose that's true, but it's going to come down a lot to, is Bobby Wagner playing?
Right.
Is KJ Wright playing? If those two players aren't playing, and we need to be real with ourselves, the Seahawks defense is not going to stop Jared Goff.
Well, are they not going to stop Jared Goff, or are they not going to stop Todd Gurley?
Neither! They're not going to stop anything.
The Seahawks game is the only time this year that Goff has completed less than 50% of his passes. The LA Rams offensive line, which has been a major strength for them all year, they've been a little bit leakier, I would say, in the last few weeks. Over his last 5 games, he's averaged 2.4 sacks per game as compared to 1.25 over the previous games. And one notable thing that came out of Sunday's game, besides for the fact that they lost that one, is that Andrew Whitworth, their star left tackle, who they added over the offseason from Cincinnati, left that game with an ankle injury and did not return. He was injured in the first half, came back in the second half, and then left for good. So we'll see. It's really too early to say what his status is.
I did not realize that could happen to other teams.
It can happen to other teams.
Okay.
So that's a notable thing, I think, to watch this week is, I mean, what's that Andrew Whitworth's available.
If Andrew Worth plays, there's a notable swing in percentage chance of victory for the Seahawks.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Another player, Robert Woods, they were without in week 14. We'll see whether he's able to get back. So it's interesting because really I would say this LA passing offense, it's been about 3 guys. We mentioned Sammy Watkins doesn't make that many catches, did not have a single catch in 4 targets against the Seahawks, but when he does make a catch, they often go for big plays, an average of 16.1 yard per catch. And then it's Cooper Kupp and Robert Woods, who are their two most frequent receivers, higher catch rates than Watkins, solid yards per catch, if not as high as him. And then when they pass to basically anyone else, it's bad. And obviously, if you take Woods out of the equation, now that's a lot more playing time for, you know, Farrell Cooper, who's not been that good this year. Other options, Tavon Austin, they basically phased him out of the rotation at this point. He's had 18 targets this year as a receiver. Those have gone for 33 yards. That's like less than Eddie Lacy's yard per carry.
He's Rawls. In Eddie Lacy territory.
He did not have a single target in Sunday's game and had just one carry, which he fumbled.
Wait, really? Oh, man.
I think that's probably a reason he was phased out. One player who was a threat against the Seahawks, somewhat surprising, is their tight end Tyler Higbee, who exploded for 98 yards receiving in that game. So we'll see if he's again able to find some of those seam routes, that sort of thing that, you know, can at times be effective against the Seahawks. That 98 yards coming on four catches for Tyler Higbee.
And I felt like watching them earlier today against the Eagles, you know, Sean McVay does so much in getting them into the right position. He's in Jared Goff's ear, kind of calling the audibles every single play. Jared Goff looks really confident moving players around because of that. But the thing that Sean McVay can't do, he can get everybody in the right position, but he can't help for pressure.
Yeah, and that's the thing, again, they were able to avoid early in the season. They've had a more difficult time lately. The Seahawks had a couple sacks in that game, but definitely the pass rush was a factor. Sheldon Richardson, I think, was a factor in that game, making some big plays.
And it's what stopped the Rams in their final drive, the final drive that they actually really had the ball in a serious drive against the Eagles. And the pass rush from the Eagles looked really good, and it kind of blew up everything they were trying to do there. But what about their run game with Todd Gurley?
So as much credit as Todd Gurley gets, yeah, they're about average in rushing DVOA. They rank 15th out of 32 teams. The interesting thing is Gurley is fourth in success rate, so he's really been kind of more consistent than he has been explosive this year, which is very different than particularly his rookie season when you saw the big plays, but not necessarily the
it's
consistent play-to-play success.
It's a very different Todd Gurley. It's like we've had 3 years of Todd Gurley and three different Todd Gurleys.
The Todd Gurley who was on my fantasy team last year was not good. Not a fan. He has been excellent as a receiver. Kind of mentioned that earlier. He's third among running backs in receiving DR entering last week. And notably, the Seahawks held him to his third lowest yardage total of the season, even though that was a point in the season where they were kind of struggling with their run defense, which has been better going forward until KJ Wright and Bobby Wagner got hurt. Oh, no.
How did that happen?
I broke you again.
God.
I broke you.
You have to play, Bobby.
Unsurprisingly, I think, given the talent and then the fact that they have Wade Phillips as the coordinator, the Rams' defense has really emerged as the better of the two units for all the credit Sean McVay gets for the offense, and which is fair because they've had a huge turnaround. But the Rams up to fourth in defensive DVOA entering last week when Philadelphia did put a lot of points on them. But
I mean, seven of those came at the very end of the game.
Yeah, I mean, those ones I'm not really counting. This is kind of the destiny of this unit, where it should have been all along had they not been so thoroughly Jeff Fishered.
I think the unit was pretty good beforehand.
But there were times where they were like 10th in defensive DVOA, and they did not have 10th talent. They had top 5 talent.
Thoroughly Jeff Fishered.
The offense probably got more Jeff Fishered, admittedly, but just everything got Jeff Fishered.
Okay, so is there any place where the Seahawks can do anything?
Well, the interesting thing is they've not been very good against the run, and specifically runs by running backs. They're 21st in defensive rushing DVOA, but they allow the second most yards per carry to running backs at 4.8 yards per carry. Only the Patriots have allowed more this season. Seahawks, I wouldn't necessarily say they took advantage of that in the game in LA. I mean, this was a real point where they were really struggling to figure out the running back rotation. Thomas Rawls and Eddie Lacy had a combined 17 carries for 39 yards in this game.
Just wait till they get a load of Mike Davis, though.
J.D. McKissick had 2 carries for no yards. So among total running backs, it was 19 carries for 39 yards, a little bit more than 2 yards per carry. Still better than Tavon Austin's receiving this year, but not good.
But they're solid against the pass.
They are very solid against the pass. They rank third in passing defense DVOA. They are fifth in adjusted sack rate. 6 players have at least 4 sacks for the Rams, led by Aaron Donald's 8. 6.5 for Robert Quinn so far this year. He added another one to that on Sunday. Aaron Donald, of course, has wreaked havoc and created nightmares for Seahawks fans for many years against them.
That's what he does.
It is. I feel better about where the offensive line is. I don't know if that's going to stop Aaron Donald.
And this is not the same kind of secondary as the Jaguars secondary. They're good, but they're not. I mean, it's not a huge break for the Seahawks. They go from the number two defense to the number four defense overall. But there might be some places where the Seahawks can find a little bit of space in that secondary.
I mean, they don't have a notable weakness. It's weird. Jacksonville's weakness was defending tight ends, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that didn't really work out.
Yeah, it was.
Weird. Weird. Jimmy Graham didn't have a catch. The Rams, by contrast, have been excellent against tight ends. They're fourth in receiving DVOA by tight ends.
Probably going to go off next week.
Jimmy Graham, if I recall correctly, did have his first touchdown of this excellent touchdown season against the Rams in LA when he got split wide. And of course, you know, that's not something that usually when you're talking about tight end performance, that it's, you know, getting them split out wide against a cornerback rather than matching them against a linebacker or a safety.
What about the Rams' typically great special teams?
It's great. And it's interesting. So, you know, oftentimes people ask, would you rather be lucky or good? The Rams have been both lucky and good. So they have the number two special teams DVOA in the NFL. Shouts to, I can never remember which fossil it is. Jim?
John Fossil.
Oh, see, I always get
Jim
it wrong.
Jim Fossil's the coach.
The head coach.
Jim Fossil's the head coach of the, former head coach of the New York Giants.
John, I guess, was the head coach at the end of last season. They are number
Wait,
one.
Was he really after Jeff Fisher got
him? Yeah, he coached in Seattle.
Oh, good for him.
They are tops in place kicking. Greg Zuerlein is 36 of 38 this season. One of his two misses on field goals coming against the Seahawks earlier this year. They are also number one in the NFL in kick returning, where Farrell Cooper gets a lot of the credit. And he's taken over as the punt returner because Austin tended to fumble a lot there, including against the Seahawks. Shockingly, they are not number one in punting. They only rate good but not great there, despite Johnny Hecker, who usually him and his coverage team rate number one in punt value. But what's also interesting, Bill Barnwell pointed this out on Twitter last week, friend of the pod. Entering last week, the Rams had gained 33 hidden points, according to Football Outsiders' calculations, on special teams. That includes opposing field goals, kickoff distance, and punt distance. Nobody else was higher than 14.5 points.
Wow.
They were more than double anyone else in the NFL. Opponents entered last week 15 of 25 on field goals against the Rams. So if you're talking about missed field goals, they'd had 9 or 8 more missed field goals against them than they'd had themselves, despite attempting 13 additional field goals.
Damn.
But, intriguingly, Jake Elliott of the Eagles went 3 of 3 against them Sunday, so that did not hold up there, and that's why it's not a predictive thing.
Okay. All that said, in this huge matchup on Sunday, that basically will determine the Seahawks' playoff fate, percentage chances of victory.
I don't feel like I have a clear picture of how this game is going to go. Mm. First off, I need to know more about the weather outlook. I think it is looking rainy next
rainy.
Week. Yeah. Yeah. Of course it is. I don't know. I mean, I feel like the Rams are the better team.
Clearly.
At the same time, I feel like the Seahawks have been able to give Jared Goff some problems, and they're at home, which has often been a favorable, they're clearly a better team at home. So, I mean, I can definitely see a variety of different outcomes here. I'm going to settle on like 45% for the Seahawks, despite the fact that they are 1-point favorites in this game.
Are they really?
They were as of last check.
Wrong team favored.
I guess it's looking like it's just going to like stop raining immediately after the game. I mean, obviously 7 days out is too certain to get that certain.
Your confidence in weather underground.
That's not. I just think it's funny. To rain, it's going to rain immediately up to and through the game, and then as soon as the game ends, it's going to stop raining.
That forecast will not change in 1 week.
If only we could have played at home today. What glorious weather for a Russell Wilson home game.
It really was pretty nice weather in Jacksonville also.
But it was a grass field.
I just look at this game and I see a Rams team who is better offensively, better defensively, better at special teams, and a Seahawks team that is ravaged by injuries. And it really depends a lot on what Bobby Wagner's status, what KJ Wright's status will be.
When Andrew Whitworth's status will be.
Those are important injuries, and we'll see what happens throughout the week. But looking at it, I'm saying that I just don't see the Seahawks defense stopping the Rams offense. I think we're going to see a lot of points from the Rams, and maybe not a ton of possessions, but I think they'll score a lot of points on the possessions that they have. It'll be very difficult for the Seahawks to stop them. And there might be some frustrating drives. You know, the end of that Jacksonville game where they had these 6-7 minute drives, maybe they end up in field goals and you're happy with it, but that's what Todd Gurley is going to do to the Seahawks defense, and it's going to be ugly. I just can't say that it's higher than a 40% chance of victory here.
Well, it's definitely a very pessimistic outlook here, which is good because the pessimist is always either right or pleasantly surprised.
I'm going to be at that game, and if the Seahawks lose, I'm not going to be pleasantly surprised.
No, that would be I'm right. Not going You'd to be right.
Even if I'm right, I'm not going to be feeling good.
Well, that would be a fitting culmination to what has been a bad week because sports are bad.
But that's next week.
Yeah.
Maybe next week will be a good week.
We'll see. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.